here for this session on Varied Voices. You're going to be hearing about a variety of programs that we have that we're recently launching and getting established at Cornell University in terms of really fostering a diverse and successful undergraduate and graduate student body. So I'm really pleased that you're here to hear about the ideas that we have underway, the new programs, the new people, and to get your questions and comments and ideas about moving forward with these different initiatives. I'm Barbara Newth. I'm Vice Provost and Dean of the Graduate School. As Vice Provost, I oversee undergraduate admissions and financial aid, and as Graduate Dean, I oversee graduate education on Cornell's campus. I'm very pleased this afternoon to be joined by four relatively new hires. All of these folks have started their positions either in April, July, August, or September. So these are really new folks, not all new to Cornell, but new to their positions. So what we're going to do is to hear from each of these individuals about the program areas they're working in, and then they'll come down to the panel seats here and we'll have a discussion with you all. So what we'll do first is hear from Lee Melvin, who's the Associate Vice Provost for Enrollment, about undergraduate admissions and financial aid. Then we'll hear from A.T. Miller, who is the Associate Vice Provost for Academic Diversity Initiatives, working strongly at the undergraduate level. Then we will hear from Renee Alexander, who is Associate Dean for Students and Director of Intercultural Programs. And then we'll hear from Sherry Notaro, who is the Associate Dean for Inclusion and Professional Development in the Graduate School. So I'm not going to introduce them each individually as they come up, but let me just tell you a few things about each one of them so you know who you're speaking with this afternoon. Lee Melvin, as I mentioned, is the Associate Vice Provost for Enrollment. He comes to us from the University of Connecticut, where he was most recently Vice President for Enrollment Planning and Management. Lee has a music background with a Bachelor of Music Education from Houston Baptist University and a master's degree in music from the University of Michigan. So he's a talented opera singer, although I've not heard him yet. I hear that, so I'm going to have to hear him soon. A.T. Miller, who will be the second speaker, is the Associate Vice Provost for Academic Diversity Initiatives. He comes to us from the University of Michigan, where he was faculty director of the Center for Global and Intercultural Study and the coordinator of multicultural teaching and learning. A.T. Has a bachelor's in American Studies from Davidson College and a PhD in American Civilization from the University of Pennsylvania. Renee Alexander, our third panelist, became the Associate Dean of Students and Director of Intercultural Programs after serving a number of years as the Director of Diversity Alumni Programs in Alumni Affairs and Development here at Cornell. She holds her bachelor's degree right here from our very own Cornell University in American History. She earned a master's from Hunter College and holds a PhD in education from Fordham University. And our fourth panelist is Sherry Notaro, who is the Associate Dean for Inclusion and Professional Development in the Graduate School. Prior to this, she was either Assistant or Associate Dean for a 10-year span at Washington University in their Graduate School. She holds a bachelor's from Washington and Lee University, and then 3 degrees from University of Michigan, 2 master's degrees, and a PhD in developmental psychology. So you have a very distinguished panel, and as I said, all of these folks have been in their positions for less than a year, in one case, just about 1 month. So they have a lot to share with you about what we're doing in admissions and financial aid, and with the graduate student and undergraduate student experience. So I'm going to ask Lee Melvin to join us first. Lee, A.T., Renee, and then Sherry, and then we'll have a panel discussion.
Thank you, Barb, for that introduction, and good afternoon to everyone. Again, my name is Lee Melvin, and I am pleased to be here with you today to present on this panel and about diversity and access at Cornell University. So I'm gonna get started with my slides because I know we'd like to have a robust conversation at the end when we're all done here. First, I'll start with what's happening in admissions and financial aid. And as Barb said, I started in mid-September, I would say. And so I've just been observing what's going on in both of those offices, those units that report directly through me, admissions and financial aid. And I'm getting a very good sense that there is a full commitment from all staff members towards diversity and how we want to interact with all of our students, but particularly with our underrepresented students on this campus, and from the commitment from the admission side to the financial aid side, with financial aid understanding not only do they have a role in the admissions piece to encourage our students to enroll here, but also with that continuing students piece as they're working with these students through any financial difficulties they have. Admissions does employ two folks that coordinate these activities, and they coordinate it on a wide scale. So they're not the only people doing these programs, but they really expect the entire office to participate in those programs. And of course, there's many programs that will occur, you know, throughout our office, and I think we've worked with our alumni closely throughout the country and internationally on doing recruitment programs for all of our students. One of the things that we must do in admissions, of course, is we need to cultivate a strong applicant pool for the university. And to do that, we can use our traditional tools. And some of the traditional tools, of course, are purchasing names from the College Board and some of the other college prep areas to get names of students who are doing very well and scoring well just on the exams. And that's when we're only looking at just the numbers part as we start there. But then there are many other opportunities for us as we try to cultivate this group. And some of the questions we're asking ourselves is, when do we reach down to cultivate these students? And is it seventh grade? Is it the eighth grade? So we're starting to explore a lot of those opportunities for us. And so, and one of the big ones for us, as you can see on this slide here, is going to be our membership with several national organizations. And we believe that that's going to help us. And this list is not exhaustive. It's just some of the places that we've worked with, like the Venture Scholars, of course, with our National Hispanic Recognition Programs and the Ron Brown Scholars. These are scholars that are identified early in the process and identified as students that have very high academic achievement and different leadership abilities. And so we're starting to work with those organizations much early on as we start to cultivate the pool. One of the things we do, of course, after we've cultivated the pool is really looking at how do we expand the diversity applicant pool. And I say expand as opposed to grow. And because grow, yes, if we get a lot more applications, that's going to be fantastic. So it gives us opportunity to choose certain students. But expanding, really looking at the depth that student brings to this process. So we have a better understanding of the type of student we're trying to enroll here on our campus, and also we can explain that to our directors of admissions about where these students are coming from and who they are, and although they're well-versed in these processes as well. So here are some of the community-based organizations that we've worked with over the past, and I asked the office to give me a list of, you know, some of the ones that they frequent the most, and this will give you an idea of all the different programs out there. And of course, if you're involved and any community-based organizations, and you'd like us to take a look at that organization to see if it fits the process that we're trying to implement here, please contact me or contact our director of admissions and provide us with additional information. So once we have the pool and we've cultivated them, and then we start looking at our strategies. And I kept this slide with very few bullet points because there's a lot more to admissions than just these recruitment strategies. But this gets at the base of some of the things that they've been doing in the past. And then as I'm looking at the program, to see what opportunities are there for us. As we look at this one, it says reduced high school visits. That doesn't mean we're not out there visiting, because what we've done is reduced high school visits so we can target certain high schools, particularly the high schools that that participate with several of those community-based organizations. So we're looking for a different way to approach our students and to get in there and work with them. And along the big piece for me on this slide really is the folks that we educate our primary college advisors and the people that we call the influencers of students. And these are the folks in these community organizations, and of course their parents are involved with this as well, and any other person that's a mentor for the student. We want to dig deep into these organizations and have them help us with our strategies. So if they identify a student, we can identify that student and advocate for them throughout the rest of the admissions process there. The other piece, after we've done a lot of our work, of course, we're always looking for what are the results of some of the strategies and things that have been going on for the last couple of years. This is one just about the applicant pool itself and what's occurred here, particularly from last year compared to the previous year as we look at the students that enrolled. And as you can see, the big part here, I'm going too fast, is that we look at this increase here with our students. This is the enrollment highlights. I'm sorry, I've gone too far over. Let me go back. There we go. Thank you. So as we look with our students, our underrepresented minority students, the total, they've gone up about 5.3%. And when you look at our over-applicant pool, it's only increased by, you know, a tenth there. So what we're looking at is, as we're really increasing our applicant pool to give us additional choices of students to select, we're starting to see that growth in the minority pool, and particularly the underrepresented minority pool. And there's different groups here, and some may notice and see where it says the multi-URM students, that 5.8% drop. We realize that that drop is occurring across the country as students have different options, particularly when it comes to checking their Hispanic and Latino background, and then how that's counted once it moves into the system. So as it's rolled up into different numbers, that's why we're seeing that reduction there. But we do see a very nice increase in our Hispanic students at any race there with our applicant pool. And so from those initiatives, you know, and this just didn't happen yesterday. I know this university has been working hard to increase the diversity of their students. And so this is, and I work with Jason Locke to ask about what's occurring in admissions and how long has he been here. And so he started giving us some history about his timeline here and what he's seen occur. So this gives you an idea about the application growth that we've realized. Of course, a wonderful application growth in the overall pool. But then as you start to break down that pool to really look at that information with our African-American students, our American Indian students, our Hispanic and Latino students, and our multicultural students, we're really seeing a nice increase there. And we want to continue that as well as we go through this process. And then once admissions gets to work, we always think about our access programs here on our campus. And the financial aid thinks about that. So as we're developing our policies and strategies and working with students, we're trying to understand what's available to our students, both our New York residents and our non-residents of the state, as we're inviting these students to join us, particularly those first-generation and low-income students. We want to understand what are the programs available to us. Have they been here on the campus? What are the other pre-summer programs available to these students? And also, as we looked at our financial aid piece, reducing that cap, the loan cap for students, to make sure that we say this is your loan cap for you based on your family income. But then also going in and looking at our priority groups, and we have priority groups that where we'll see a student say, this student really is a priority for Cornell. So how do we get the student to reduce that cap so the family won't have to take out so many loans and we can still be competitive when we're trying to enroll this student? And so financial aid has been working hard the last couple of years, working on several initiatives, doing the travel with our peers around the country, but also doing more outreach with students and families and using technology with chats and blogs, but also targeting students that we identify and say, we really need you to explain to the students about the options of financing their higher education and what we can do when we let them, what it means when you say, you will not have a gap in your education once your finances once we put your package together. So that's going to be extremely important to us, and they're continuing to work and develop new programs, and we're going to continue to look at that. And we looked at some of our other piece with the Ivy Match and the Stanford, Duke, and MIT piece as we increase our outreach to those students to explain to them what does the Ivy Match mean to them and what does it mean to us as we're trying to enroll them onto our campuses. So after we've gone through all those pieces, then we start getting to our enrollment numbers. And we've had a very good year with enrollment with our underrepresented minority students. And we're excited about that, and we want to retain that. We are seeing fluctuation in yields when it comes to our African-American students based on the admit pool. So as we'll continue to dig into this data to see what occurs for us, you know, with these students. Again, you'll see that reduction in the multi-URM students, and that's a reduction as students continue to identify themselves with other different groups. But right now, we're pretty pleased, and the one that gives me pause is really what's happening with our American Indian students group there. So we're going to look into that issue, and I have some meetings scheduled with our American Indian, Native American populations and the leaders in those programs to see what is it we can do better to try to attract more students here to our campus. And after we've done all of those, and with my short time here at the university, I've been thinking about a few goals that I'd like to see implemented and also reached while we're here. And these are just goals for today, just so you know, this will continue to evolve as I get more information about the university. But big pieces for me is really as I look at our communication with our schools and college admissions directors. And I think that's important that we continue to explain to them about what we're seeing in the marketplace and how they're working with our different applicant pools and the opportunities available to our students. And they know a lot of this information. So we're excited about that part, that we'll continue to grow that information there. And also our collaboration with our CBOs, our community-based organizations, we want to strengthen that piece. Folks that work with these students daily so they can provide us with information that we can share to the rest of our folks. And then, of course, focus on assessment and sharing data. And as I look to see who has what information. I believe there's some data that we could share to others to enhance how they may review certain files of students. So we want to make sure that that occurs. And then increase our visibility in diverse communities. And I think that's extremely important for an institution, if you're, and based on the resources we have, that you really should be visible. And so people can come up and talk to you about how it works at Cornell, the admissions process, and encourage that student to apply, but also explaining what highly selective admissions means to an applicant so they don't get discouraged, or we don't discourage that community after one of their top students applies and then that person's not admitted. And then we look at, finally, you know, to seek funds, additional funds to help us reach our enrollment goals, particularly when it comes to our underrepresented students. That's an enormous piece for us. With the funding, that does help students decide which institution they'd like to enroll in and why they will stay there. And from the program that I attended last night, late in the evening, speaking with many of our minority students, financial aid came up a lot. And they said they were very thankful for what Cornell has done for them and that they look forward to contributing to this institution when they leave. So that ends my report, and thank you very much.
These are Renee Alexander's slides.
Good afternoon, and thank you for coming. I'm looking around the audience, and I see some very familiar faces. Hi, Jeff Berg. I want to thank all of you who participated in our networking event last night that Lee just referenced. Students were out in grand numbers, and a fun time was had by one and all. And thank you for engaging our students. The room was certainly diverse, and I'm going to touch on that in just a minute. My theme here is intercultural Cornell, and what does that have to do with access? Lee has very aptly touched on the access piece, the admissions enrollment piece, the financial aid piece. So once students get here, what kind of environment do they find, what they are exposed to? I'm going to frame my discussion. This was from a previous presentation, so let me tell you briefly what I'm going to talk about is this whole concept and notions of intercultural Cornell. I'm going to talk about what's going on at 626 Thurston Avenue, our wonderful, fabulous new student space, and what program areas are there, and then close out with some finishing thoughts on what intercultural Cornell means. I always start my discussions around diversity and the student experience with these four bullet point areas that David Harris helped us frame a couple of years ago, several years ago. Compositional engagement, inclusion, inclusive, and academic achievement. Compositional, the obvious structural demographic component, it's the most obvious, but it certainly is not sufficient to achieve our diversity goals. We are doing a tremendous job in terms of recruiting and maintaining the most diverse classes in the history of the university. So once we get them here, how are they engaging across difference? Do they default back to their social, racial, and ethnic groups, or are we helping them work across all this tremendous diversity? Cornell is a smorgasbord of sorts, a diverse buffet of choices here, and so we need to do a better job, I think, of helping our students work across issues of diversity now that we have them here and we're trying to engage them. Inclusion. Does everybody feel comfortable? Does everybody feel warm and welcome on this campus? Would you go back to your high school and say, Cornell is the place for me, and I think that you should check it out? And then the academic piece, which my colleague A.T. Miller is going to touch on. Do we have students who are just getting by, or is everyone here able to take advantage of the academic offerings and finish Cornell, not bumping a lot along at the bottom, but doing well and excelling academically? I'm not going to spend much time on this slide, but what I would like for you to take away from here is how diverse our audiences are, that there is no longer a majority of any racial group here. We have a plurality, and that white Caucasian students, class of 2015, are about 41%. We have about 9.9% who do not identify, so there are probably some white students in that category, but we no longer have a majority here, so it makes for quite a plurality on campus. This is something that I think we need to pay very close attention to, and I can't see it so well, so let me come out this way. Okay. Is it on? Okay. Neighborhoods where students grew up from, and you can't see this, the names here, but these are white students, Asian American, I should say, underrepresented minorities, multicultural, multiracial students, and international students. Why is this important? Because 90% of our white students come from mostly or completely white neighborhoods. However, if you take a look at our underrepresented minorities, about 40% come from mostly or completely white neighborhoods as well. And the flip side is 33% come from mostly or completely non-white communities. Quite a mixture. Look at Asian students. Just over 50% come from mostly or completely white communities as well, but almost 40% come from mostly or completely non-white communities. So like I like to tell my colleagues, you don't really quite know who's walking into your office. I missed one. High school that I attended in terms of racial composition. Again, white students, almost 80% come from mostly or completely white high schools, but half of our Asian students and half of our underrepresented minorities come from mostly or completely white high schools as well. But the flip side is one-third of our URNs come from mostly or completely non-white schools, and about 20% of our Asian students. And look at our internationals, almost 40% come from high schools that are mostly or completely non-white. So what does all this mean? The one data point that I don't have up here is the number of students that come to Cornell who want to engage across difference. About two-thirds, and this is from the freshman survey, class of 2014, about two-thirds of our students say that they come to Cornell to engage across diversity. That fact drives my thoughts as we are pioneering these new programs. Students come here looking for it. So why is this important? Why are we moving in this direction? Because working across difference aligns with our strategic plan of building multicultural competencies in our students. As we approach the year 2015 and our sesquicentennial, we are trying to position Cornell as a global university and create global citizens by way of interacting with each other across difference. It certainly enriches campus life and impacts a very positive campus climate. And so we want to work on a program that we want to institutionalize that is built for last, helping students work across difference. And like I said, this really drives my thoughts as we are beginning to put these programs together. Let me shift gears to 626 Thurston Avenue, former Alumni House. I'm sure some of you were there when it was Alumni House. Okay. I'm running out of time already, guys, so I'm going to have to speed this up. We just moved into this fabulous brand new center, and the programs that are housed there are the LGBT Resource Center, Asian American Center, Alumni Student Mentoring Program, ALANA, which is a programming board, and a funding board which distributes about $90,000 a year to basically diverse student organizations. I am pioneering student development diversity initiatives, which is the old community component from OMEA, the Office of Minority Educational Affairs. That helps students of color build community. It helps reinforce and support them being comfortable here, being satisfied with their Cornell experience. And we work on issues of leadership development and sending students to conferences where they learn to work as a team. Closing out with this whole concept of intercultural Cornell, it's something that our students want. They are quietly working across difference in their own ways. You have students working together,
boards programming that would have been unheard of a generation ago. Black Students United working with Hillel, Center for Jewish Living, Pakistani students working with Christians and Jewish students. They're looking to the university for support and leadership, and they are going to help us pioneer this whole concept of intercultural Cornell. So I'm going to stop there and turn the mic over to my colleague, A.T. Miller. Let's see if we have you queued up, A.T. Oh, yeah. I got to close on this picture, guys. You got to like that. You know, this is 1972, and the hair is just not growing that long anymore. So here you go, A.T. Thank you, everybody.
Let us be uncomfortable together. Let us depend upon surprises. The unexpected is a place we hope to find most every day, and by the way, we get there, moving off the trodden path. What difference makes is wisdom, as knowledge brings the unfamiliar home. The educated one is all unbounded and is never one, not truly singular, as through the curiosity, the we flows in and out to all the others who have come to know. Above, below, in front of us, we look behind the simple sign of who we are. We raise a flag, but don't salute before another flag is raised, devoted in our hours and days to signs and wonders, semaphore that by interpretation tells us more about our many selves. Do come in. Don't be our guest. This house is theirs and yours. So I am here since July 1st directing a new initiative called the Office of Academic Diversity Initiatives. We've chosen to pronounce our acronym since Wadi means a cool protected path through the desert in Arabic and Swahili. Our vision is really to take the concept of any student in any study and think about every student in every study, experiencing the full diversity of dynamic and stimulating exchange with each other. So having all these any people together, a greatly enriched environment is when they all know each other, when they interact, as Renee pointed out. Our mission, of course, is to particularly serve those students who historically have not appeared in higher education. And so our office tries to enhance the experience so that those students are on an equal footing with the students who often have traditionally been here, who have assumed their whole lives they'd go to college. In fact, some of you are their parents and you assumed they'd be at Cornell all their lives. We have a new space in the CCC, which includes a computer lab for our students, as well as a student lounge area and study area. What's nice for me is that this is right outside my own office, so that every day I'm with these students. It's very easy in an administrative role to get separated from the student body. I'm unlikely to teach this year, and I'm not sure about future years. As you might have guessed from my poem, I'm in the English department. But being there with the students is such a benefit to those of us who do this work. We do have some continuing programs that come out of the former OMEA. These include the New York State Opportunity Programs, EOP and HEOP, as well as our pre-professional programs. C-STEP is the acronym for the New York State funding, and C-POP is what Cornell funds to duplicate those programs for all Cornell students. And these are pre-professional opportunities where students can shadow professionals. It's also an opportunity for those of you in the room, if you would like to have students know about your profession or your professional life, perhaps during a few days in the January break or in the summer. We fund students to be able to do that so that they don't go down the long road of whatever professional school and discover, I don't like that, or I didn't know that's what those people do, or vice versa. They're thinking about a field but don't really quite know what it is, and being immersed with a real professional, a fellow Cornellian, opens that door to say, okay, that's exactly what I want to do. We also, in our office, have a work-study fund where we partner with institutions. In the past, OMEA mostly looked on this as a way to assist our students in their financial aid packages, which is a very important part of this. As an academic unit, we're trying to make sure that, those jobs or work opportunities match with the academic program of the students. So we emphasize work with undergraduate research or with community internships with local agencies in the Ithaca area, as well as support for putting our students working in offices that also support diversity initiatives around campus, gender studies programs, ethnic studies, as well as the administrative units like 626 Thurston. We do have our own student organizations, but these are, of course, the academic and professionally based student organizations. And one of the things our office tries to do is get the leadership of these various organizations across the colleges and departments and throughout the university together so that they can more effectively use their resources in terms of practice interviews, career advising, all of those sorts of things. Some of these organizations, for example, NOMAS is the National Organization of Minority Architects, which actually has very few members on the Cornell campus. It's not a large program to begin with, all of our architecture students. And so for them to be able to work with other underrepresented student organizations, of course, gives far more bang for their resources and not sort of duplicating efforts in all the various colleges and institutions. We're also, as Sherry Notaro will point out in her presentation, trying to link the whole pipeline together. So Lee talked about working with organizations that prepare students before they're on our campus. In the undergraduate phase, we're also wanting our students looking forward to graduate and professional work and have our graduate and professional students mentor people that they see as like themselves, just as our undergraduates will be working with the outreach that Lee does to mentor students in situations that they were in their high school years. We have a number of new initiatives going on. We have a lunch series where students meet successful alumni as well as graduate students and people on campus who can support their academic efforts. Our program Meeting of the Minds is about getting our students involved with the non-classroom intellectual activity of the university. So attending graduate colloquia, speakers on campus, performances, charrettes where design work is presented. In all of these settings, very often, especially our first generation college students, the first people in their families to get higher education, or our low income students, our underrepresented students, are not necessarily comfortable or even familiar with going to such an event. And so having them go as a group with one of our advisors and then having their own discussion after observing the discussion that happens at the event often is a way to demystify how these things happen on campus and to understand that participating in these things enhances your academic work. It isn't a time waste or drawing you away from your homework and those kinds of reading, but it actually can stimulate that as well as being a social environment. So getting used to the social environment of intellectual life is something that undergraduates often miss, and we think it's really important for those students to excel. Because one of our missions is really to have the students in our programs at the very top of Cornell classes. Renee already spoke about this, but we want to see our students receiving fellowships, honors, internships to go out of here with Eisenhowers and Marshalls and Rhodes and Fulbrights and not simply struggling to survive in Ithaca. So we're really looking to enhance the way we bring these students together so that they really know each other and can be cultivated for these honors. It often takes 1 or 2 years of preparation to really be a great candidate for these, and we want to have that capacity in our office. We're actually hiring an assistant director to be in charge of this right now so that those students are identified early and interacting well with all of the students who are part of WADI programs. We're putting in a proposal for a McNair grant. McNair is a federal program that recruits and stimulates students who are underrepresented in graduate fields to go on for PhDs. Our graduate school already receives a lot of McNair scholars, but we don't have a McNair program ourselves on our campus. We're going to be broadening our outreach to make sure that what state programs are so effective at helps our students who don't come from the state of New York. And some of these look-alike students come through various programs that Lee has already identified. We're looking to build our capacity in terms, we now have research capacity within our office, working on identifying early the first generation college and low-income students to support undocumented students. And the Center for Teaching Excellence also reports to me. And that's for a very strategic reason. We don't want to just adapt our students to Cornell. We want Cornell and our classrooms and our faculty to build the capacity to teach inclusively, to have a curriculum that reaches all students, and to use the most effective methods so that everyone benefits from this interactive climate. I would just want to close by describing we're looking to have an intergroup dialogue project where for academic credit, students are actually getting together across difference, really probing deeply into social structure, privilege, power in our society, how it isn't just you determining yourself on this campus, but it's the eyes of each other and the ears listening to each other that looks towards what the future can be in your academic career. And so we're excited that a program based in academics for credit will be a major contributor in shifting the climate and building intercultural skills in our students so that when they leave Cornell, they can hit the ground running with strangers anywhere in the world that they find themselves. Thank you.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm glad to be here with you today. I'm glad to follow with my colleagues, Lee and Renee and AT. We've been working very closely together, and we will continue to do so. So I'm going to talk just a bit about graduate students and underrepresented graduate students in particular and helping to foster their success and their achievement. So I'm going to focus in on three areas today that I think will really be important in trying to describe to you our programming. First of all is access and recruitment, funding and affordability, and student support and academic achievement. So first of all, we are going to talk a little bit about funding graduate students. And at the graduate school, we have several layers of funding that's really designed to support our students. So first, I'm going to use this mic. Apparently, I'm a little too low here. Is that better? Okay. So first of all, we have funding for recruitment visits. So students who are underrepresented can come to Cornell in the spring semester and visit the departments in the fields and really get a sense of what we have to offer. And the fields can request funding for these visits. Additionally, we do have funds to fund me to go out to recruitment fairs and faculty to go out to recruitment fairs and meet our prospective students and start to develop those relationships. The second type of funding is really designed to provide support and a firm academic background for our students who are coming in on diversity fellowships. And so for new PhD students, we do have funding through provost scholarships that will fund 2 years of stipends, summer awards, and student health insurance. And the graduate fields then guarantee the remainder of the funding. And in order to be eligible for these fellowships, our students need to talk about diversity and how they can really best meet diversity here in an essay format. And so they talk about several types of criteria, including being from a disadvantaged background, first generation college student, or a member of a historically underrepresented group in higher education. And then for our continuing students who are already here and who are quite advanced in their program, we do have a Provost Diversity Fellowship, and that is one semester of funding. And that really is for our students who are just about finished but need about one more semester to finish up. And that does carry a living stipend tuition and student health insurance, and the same criteria for diversity applied for both our fellowships, for the new and the continuing. So next I want to move on and talk just a little bit more about supporting our students in terms of retention and completion and really academic success and making sure that our students are successful while they're here. So one of the things that we really focus on is enhancing professional development opportunities. So we want our students to do things that are creative, such as going to diversity conferences where they present their work, where they're amongst a peer group that they don't usually get to see. Many times our underrepresented students are only one in their department, in their lab. So when they go to conferences such as the Edward A. Boucher Conference, that was really founded by Yale and Howard in 2005 to honor Edward A. Boucher, who was the first African American to receive a PhD, and he received it in physics in 1876. We induct students into this prestigious honor society, and they're able to present their work and to meet peers and to really network with hundreds of other students like themselves. It's a very uplifting event for them and allows them to see really what is possible in their professional lives. The other thing that we're really interested in doing is bringing our graduate students together in symposia where they can present their work to a wide variety, a wide audience who are not specialists in their field, and it gives them the opportunity really to talk to non-specialists. And this is not something that they typically get in their graduate program. They're very used to talking to professors and other graduate students who are specialists and know exactly what their topics are. But when they have to talk about their work to someone in biology, let's say, and they're a humanist, it really does open up their ability to talk about transferable skills, to talk about their work in this different setting. And so that's something that we want to work with undergraduates and postdoctoral fellows and faculty, and to bring together this different array of professionals to talk about their work. We're also very interested in mentoring. As AT said, we really want to pursue a developmental model of mentoring so that we have graduate students offering mentoring to our undergraduate students, such as those in the WADI program, also Mellon May's undergraduate students. We want graduate students to mentor each other through peer mentoring, and we want graduate students to receive mentoring through relationships with postdoctoral fellows, such as the new Mellon May's postdoctoral fellowship program, and also to receive mentoring from faculty and alumni. Also, we're going to partner with WADI, as AT mentioned. We're going to have graduate students participating in the Tuesday Lunch Series to talk to our undergraduates about graduate school, to make it more accessible for them, to make them understand that it's very possible for them as well to attend graduate school, and to talk about funding options. We're also going to be hosting seminars, panels, and workshops. We have a panel coming up next week called Making the Transition to Graduate School, and that is for our first year underrepresented students to really give them a sense of tips for success and how to really navigate graduate school. And that will be a panel discussion with our current underrepresented graduate students. So basically, that is just a little bit about what we're doing with graduate school and our underrepresented students, and really trying to make sure that all these pieces are in place, the access, the funding, and the student support, because when our students leave here, we want them to be successful. We want them to be able to access careers. We want them to be able to give back to their community and to give back to Cornell. Thanks.
To have this group of experts here with us. It's phenomenal what they have underway already. I'm hoping that many of you who were here at Cornell a long time ago are sensing that there are some real differences that are going on at Cornell. We're delighted to have you here as our ambassadors out to the rest of the world to spread the good news about what it is that we have going on here at Cornell and how we're improving our support and experience for both undergraduate and graduate students. So with that in mind, I'd like to open it up for your questions and your comments, and I think we have two mics here so that the folks can respond to you. So yes, go ahead.
Demographic of black students increasingly being from very affluent immigrant populations and whether that really benefits the black community or the resources should be used elsewhere. When looking at diverse classes, is a black student a black student, a black student? Are they all the same, or is there really a push to use those resources to help students who might use that education to benefit their families and their communities and not otherwise access the education?
Okay, thank you for that question. I think it's some. The answer is yes to both, I would say. And when we are evaluating applications, we really are looking at the student's background. We prefer to do a holistic review of an applicant. And so if they are an African-American student, African background from Africa, like let's say Nigeria or Ghana, I don't think we would want to separate them as well if we were to say just race in general as black. I didn't have a chance to review that article, but I've reviewed others that have mentioned this same notion that with the affluent African-Americans and those you know with less income, are they taking the place of students or having some advantage? And I think if we look at the short-term impact of that, some may say yes, that some people are working the system, as they would call it. But I think when we look at the long-term impact, particularly in our country and in our world, with particularly for people of color in America, then I don't think that we would want to take something away from another student just because of that they've had some advantages in their life. But we are still looking at diversity from different lenses. And we need that socioeconomic diversity. We need that intellectual diversity. And as we continue to work with our student populations, we're looking to see which students can achieve in a highly selective institution. And those students, they're going to be from varied groups. And we have that from all races. It's not just our minority races, but it's from all races there. So it could be, the answer is yes, you know, I would say, as you mentioned, on both. But I don't think we should discourage any applicants from applying or change our review process based on their heritage.
Let's go back there and then we'll head towards the middle.
I'm thinking about my experience from the 80s when freshmen arrived and West Campus was predominantly white and North Campus was everyone else, and how now everyone sits on the hill on North Campus. And then I see, I guess from Renee, some of the information on the demographic, at least the experiences as described by the students when they arrive in terms of their neighborhoods and the demographics of their school. And I think about how the job that you've done, increasing the number of visible minorities on campus, and I say to myself, wow, you brought them all in, how do you get them to interact in a way that is meaningful, in a way that doesn't force this wonderful opportunity to fall in on itself? Because we as humans tend to want to be around others who have similar views, thoughts, experiences. And in the tradition of Cornell, where we tend to do that, what we've tended to do that over the years, that must be a great paradox you're trying to solve there. So I'm interested, you know, in how you are addressing that, both theoretically and practically.
I'll start, and I thank you for that comment and for your observations. When I was a student here in the early 1970s, describing this intercultural concept and moving students together who want to work together would have been virtually impossible. You are from the 80s?
86.
Okay, all right, you're a little younger than I am. Cornell is a very different place. And as we described, compositionally, we're doing a remarkable job. But from an engagement standpoint, we get these students here. What can we do to get them more involved, cross-pollinating, so to speak? There are a number of student initiatives that are going on right now that are organic. They are from the ground up, and the students are doing this on their own. They're quiet. To the casual eye, when you walk across campus, you may not see it. But for someone who's on the ground working with students, we see it on a regular basis. So I'd like to say that students are demanding difference. They are pushing the envelope, they are breaking down barriers, and they're doing it on their own. What my suggestions are is to build some structure and support around this to help students, to let them lead, but also let us lead so that they may learn. Okay, this inter in 18 didn't, well, he was not able to dwell on it for too long, but I'm going to give the mic to him in just a minute so he can talk about this course that we're going to be offering hopefully in the near future, which is designed, and it's academic, it's 4 credit. We hope to engage about 1,000 students a year. Let me let you get into that, okay? Let him do the numbers. But we do have students coming here. In spite of these racial differences that they're coming from, the high schools and the neighborhoods that they live in, they really want to come here to experience difference. This is a very different generation, and they are pioneering this on their own. When you look around the cafeterias, do students default back to their racial and ethnic groups? Yes, on the surface. But there are lots of examples of students, like I said, doing this on their own, and we are going to step up and take more leadership role in helping them work through these issues and connect across difference. Let AT add to this, and then we'll get to you, Dean.
So just briefly, I think that what is exciting is not only are students demanding it, of course, employers in graduate schools are saying, do you have the intercultural skills to work in our environment, to work across the world? And students know this. So it's both a personal curiosity. They come to Cornell saying, it's a diverse place and I want to learn from that. But they also know these are skills I've got to have. And so the point of the course is we would serve about 200 students a semester in small groups, working with a professor, a curriculum, but peer facilitated, and really explore in an intense way how to really listen to each other, to talk about personal experience related to each other, but also see in these groups, which nominally at the beginning of a semester might be a dialogue between men and women, and suddenly realize, oh, when you said women, I didn't know you meant two Asian women would be there. You know, they suddenly see the many facets of everyone's identity and start connecting through those varied facets of each other's personal background, as well as the things they're reading, studying, experiencing through sort of experiential workshop type experiences. And all of these dialogues end with an action project. The students are writing a paper, but they're also expected to do something as a group as a result of what they're learning from each other. So we think this can have a very transformative effect on the campus.
Let's do one here and then we'll move over. Yeah, go ahead.
My question kind of builds on what you were asking. Our son is a freshman in Dixon. He's made 2 good friends in Ujima. And one is black and one is white. They're roommates. Both of them said they didn't request that dorm. And my son just expressed surprise that they had the dorm, Ujima, which he said was predominantly black. And I guess I'm just wondering, do you think that hinders trying to get people to interact better, or is it there because there's largely a comfort area for students who want to be there, and like how do they get placed in that dorm?
How do students get placed in Ujima? Some of them requested, and Ujima is a program house that is, I guess it espouses the African diaspora experience. There are black students that live in Ujima because they grew up in overwhelmingly white neighborhoods, as that statistic that I showed you, and they want to experience learning more about Caribbeans and people from the continent of Africa and the African-American experience. There are Caucasian students and others, Asian students, who are placed there just because it's a room and we don't have enough space in other residence halls. So your question is?
Does that hinder? I guess I just wondered if you think having a dorm like that, if that hindered the students interacting together. I have to say, both boys have liked being in Ujima, mm-hmm. and my son enjoys spending time there. Mm-hmm. It was just interesting to me that
Most students self-select to be there, and does it hinder? In my personal view, I would say absolutely not. That's like saying a black student living in, say, Dixon, where the students are overwhelmingly white, hinders interaction among people of color or white students interacting with black students. So this campus is open, and people will find their way to their communities. In fact, my personal experience with white students that have lived in Ujima is that it's a transformative experience for them, that they experience difference. They know what it's like to be a minority. often something that they have never experienced before. So I personally could defend Ujamaa's right to exist, having lived there my freshman year, fall semester my freshman year, and messing with my closest friends. Yes.
I lived there, and I have to say, you know, it's kind of validation when you live there, when people that are not of color come there to learn about your culture, when your whole life you've been forced to blend in and accept other people's cultures, the majority. So it kind of makes me feel good when people start defending and espousing our culture and our beliefs and whatever we do, and they come to our residence to do so. And so it makes me proud to be, you know, that I'm part of this community where there's people that actually, you know, value what I value.
Let's go back there. Yes, go ahead. You, yes.
Yeah, first of all, yes. Let's let the fire out. And I live in New York, so I'm really happy to have it. That having been said, so are the statistics up here. Renee, I was kind of from your era, although not quite. My question is, having been involved in the university for a number of years and coming to a lot of these presentations, you know, what we always see are snapshots. Mm-hmm. What I don't see and haven't seen are historical numbers. I mean, the anecdotal where the discussion is that back after the straight takeover, we had a lot more African American students than we have now. I don't know if that's true or not. It could be a myth. It could be true. But first of all, hopefully next time, I'd like to see some kind of trend analysis. And the second thing is, what is the truth of that?
I can tell you that the data from the late 60s into the early 70s is not as crisp and concise as it is today. And in fact, the university did not collect accurate data on race back then. I did hear Jeff Lehman, the former president of the university, get up in front of my class at a reunion event in June of 2004. We had a joint meeting of all students in my class, and Jeff made a public statement that the class of 1974 was the largest class of African descent in the history of the university, which makes sense because the Willis Drake Hall takeover in some ways drove admissions for the next few cycles, but it was also an admissions philosophy that was gaining in strength as we admitted more African American students in the late 1960s into the 1970s, the early 70s. The data is hard to come by because, like I said, records were not kept as accurately as they are today. But that is the university's position, is that the class of 74 and the class of 75 were the largest classes of African heritage in the history of the university.
Well, what about 1980, for example?
It dropped. Nationally, the largest class in higher ed was 1977. So it happened nationwide. And then there was a steady drop during the 80s, a recovery during the 90s.
And Renee, maybe next time, if you could have whatever data you have, it would be interesting to see.
Right, I think that's an important point because Renee made a comment about President Lehman's tenure, but it's been a while actually since President Lehman was president, and we have seen some shifts in enrollment. So I think your point is well taken, but we have had some changes even since that time.
That number was about 275 for the class of 74, by the way.
Go ahead.
Yes. I think this is a wonderful forum, and I'm really excited that all that's being done. But white students have a lot of work to do. And I don't hear any effort being made to get white students to be more comfortable and involved in the multicultural community. And that troubles me, because we really have to make progress on that.
Yeah, there are many white students both in CCC and especially where Renee is doing her work. And the Intergroup Dialogue Program is entirely predicated on this is the program where every student at Cornell is involved with our centers. But Renee can expand on that.
I can, and thank you for bringing that up. That is a critical point, that as we get more involved in this intercultural dialogue, this intercultural concept of students coming together across difference, white students are deeply and integrally involved in this. Without them at the table, this is just a bunch of students of color talking to each other and getting together. The leadership of Student Assembly and a number of student organizations, including Cornell Hillel, the Center for Jewish Living, and other mainstream organizations are very deeply engaged in this, talking across difference, engaging across difference. And will there be some tension? Certainly. Will there be some assumptions about people that we have to bring down? Absolutely. But white students are at the table and they are driving the bus.
I'm a trustee of Cornell Hillel, and I do know that Hillel is deeply involved, but I have not heard that other groups of white students are equally involved.
And as I said, it's a very quiet movement, that if you were on the ground, that you would be much more engaged and in tune with it as I am. But students are very, very, and the leaders, I'm looking for leaders. The Student Assembly is deeply involved in this and others, and so it's, being a Cornellian from old school, it's really a delight to be here and see this happen organically from the ground up. Students really, really are driving this, and we are going to put the structure and support around it.
Let's do one here. Yeah, go ahead.
I can't answer that question in depth today, but I am investigating what our social media strategy is at this time. I do know that the Offices of Admissions and Financial Aid have implemented several social media programs to help them reach students. One, for example, I will start with the Zinch product that they use to reach some international students. The other programs that they're working with, of course, you know, through Facebook and other opportunities for them, and as students form their own groups on in those environments, the office is working hard to be involved in this as they're invited. But I can't give you all the other details because I'm still just starting to uncover some of the pieces there.
Let's do one more question. Yeah, go ahead. You haven't had a chance.
Yeah, so I thought it was really interesting what you're trying to do, the old building, putting together all of these groups and everything. But I'm wondering, and it's maybe a little bit, I want a little more clarification as to what do you do to encourage the predominantly white either social groups or, you know, whatever the unions are here at the school that are predominantly white to actually not, you know, choose not to be so predominantly white. And what do you do for, you know, students that are minorities to encourage them to go out and integrate? Because I think a lot of the problems are that the students are also feel intimidated. And I know this firsthand because I met with my scholarship student just the other day. And this is a person that is social and bubbly, and she's extraordinary. And she said that she really did feel, although she's very involved, she felt discrimination. You know, she really did feel a pushback. And when she was looking to join a predominantly white group, it was her minority counterparts that said, oh, you're gonna have a bad experience. You shouldn't do that. She did it anyway, she had a great experience, but still feels, you know, this tension. So what can we do to help the minority students just get out there, take the chances, right? And go into these predominantly white groups, the Greek groups, right? The Greek sororities, fraternities, or whatever the different associations are, and how can we get them also to be more accepting and inclusive?
Well, I think, you know, as we've mentioned, there are a fair number of students who are really being active about this.
These tensions are going to exist. There's no question that we are breaking down barriers that have existed for a very long time. there are old attitudes that have to be shattered and removed, and they will take time. However, the kind of movement that I'm describing to you is happening now. It's happening in many different population groups. There will be some pushback, but what I envision is students sitting down and working on this, and us putting the research and the theory and the support and the structure behind these programs as we move forward. And this is going to take some time, but it's a fascinating movement to be a part of. And again, I'm not surprised to hear reports like that. That's going to happen. But the movement is going, and I guess it's organic. It's, the students are doing it now, and there will be those that are not going to be on board with it.
And I think that students are also looking for a more natural and structured way to do this. You know, what becomes tension-filled is a student who sort of plops down, you know, next to somebody and says, oh, I'd like to get to know you, or, you know, what's life like on the reservation? And, you know, I think I gotta go to class right now. You know, I mean, it's a very awkward encounter. And so providing a structure that makes it, oh, okay, there's a natural way to do this. There is an organic way to be involved, to learn about each other, to go to an event at Ujamaa, to, you know, to have these places around campus where it's expected. But I think there is, we can't move Cornell out of the United States and the social structure that exists around them or out of those high schools or neighborhoods they come from. So that is going to exist. But I think that other universities are really experiencing a great deal of pressure from employers. There are employers who have told major universities, we won't recruit your students anymore because they come out of here and they mess up our workplace because they don't know how to deal across difference. And I won't name names, but I do know the corporations and I do know the universities where that's happened. Students know this. You know, they're increasingly hearing that in an interview, and they're not being asked, what is your personal attitude? They're being asked, how can you demonstrate that you are skilled at working with varied people? And they have to be able to say, I went to this conference, I was in this organization at Cornell, I took these classes, you know, and so providing those, as Renee said, in some ways we're sort of behind what the demand is among our students and among the people who expect to get great graduates from Cornell.
At this, just mindful of time, I want to thank you all for attending. I think our panelists are able to stay for a few minutes more, so if you'd like to come down and have one-on-one conversations, please feel free to do that. Also, please help me thank the panelists.